Welcome to Ask an Atheist with Sam Mulvey. Sam is off this week, but it's me, Becky, here in the studio along with Dan. How are you?
I'm doing great, Becky.
So last week you did not have the opportunity to comment and throw in your two cents about Buzz Aldrin's wonderful facial expressions for the best words segment, where we colorfully quipped about Trump's musings about the cosmos.
Yeah, I would have to say that Buzz Aldrin has done a lot of things in his life that I consider quite heroic. Obviously, he went to the moon. Cool. But I think my second favorite thing was
Is this the face punch?
Yes, a moon landing denier, a guy who believed that it was a hoax and was consistently just rude and obnoxious and followed Aldrin and other astronauts around, trying to like call them out, these profanities and charlatans in public year after year after year. Finally, Buzz just had enough and knocked the guy out. And it was just such a beautiful, like, well-executed, well-landed punch. And I want to be clear. I'm not a big proponent of violence. I think there's generally a better way to solve almost anything. But, you know, the bad part of me says, you know, when somebody, gosh, when they really have it coming, it's sort of fun to see. You know, there's just the little bit of Schadenfreude in there that says, like, yeah, he deserved that.
Yeah, you know? Well, you know, for all of those moon landing skeptics out there, that's not exactly what we mean when we talk about Ask an Atheist as a show related to and concerning skepticism and separation of church and state and atheism and humanism. But you may call in to our toll-free voicemail, 844-SKEPTIC. We'd love to have some moon landing deniers. That would be awesome.
I promise I won't punch anybody.
Long-distance cyber punching. So we do have a follow-up on this, though. So Trump had called Pence very much into space and had named him to some head of some resurrected committee. And, some things happened with Mike Pence. Mike Pence, who will be chairing the newly resurrected National Space Council, shocked social media when a photo began circulating of him touching NASA hardware just above a printed "Do Not Touch" sign. NASA reported that the signs placed on the critical space flight hardware at the Kennedy Space Flight Center were merely a day-to-day reminder, and that no damage had been done, and that any hardware was going to be cleaned prior to use. Vice President Pence joked on Twitter that Senator Marco Rubio, who accompanied the Kennedy tour, had dared him to do it. What do you make of this, Dan?
Well, so the piece of hardware in question was the forward hatch cover for the Orion spacecraft, and oh boy, there is a giant "Do Not Touch" sign right there. And ignoring that, I think, kind of makes you either an idiot or a tool. And I'm not really sure which one to apply in this situation. But I'm kind of in line with NASA's response that, oh yeah, you know, we put that sign on there, but really, we were going to clean this afterwards.
Well, it is protocol to actually wipe down and clean everything to make sure that there's no, you know, particulate matter or anything like that. You know, that there is a real protocol for having done that.
Right. And it's exactly how I would respond if I had Mike Pence and Marco Rubio in my house. Believe me, I would clean everything as soon as they left.
Oh, man, I don't even want to think about Mike Pence and Marco Rubio in my house, in my stomping grounds. And you know what, though? Here's the better thing. Mike Pence and Marco Rubio are not in charge of, Marco Rubio is not in charge of anything space related, as far as I understand, apart from, you know, Florida-ness or whatever.
Right.
But, you know, Pence is now in charge of the National Space Council. And here he is, you know, in the house of the space technicians and astronauts and engineers, and they kind of have to, you know, tread lightly, if you will.
Right. Yeah, I'm sure they're afraid of getting defunded. I'm not, so so I guess I can say whatever I want. And I'd like to say that this administration seems to have a real problem with touching stuff they're not supposed to touch.
Well, you know, Mike Pence, all we have to do is declare the Orion space capsule to be female, and then Mike Pence wouldn't be allowed to be alone with
that. Oh, he won't even have dinner with it.
Yeah. Lest he put his dirty paws all over it. You know, it reminds me actually of something that's really essential to, like, you know, child development 101, being a teacher, you working in youth development, being an educator, and, you know, being in camp with me. You know, you have this trick. If you want kids to get, you know, if you want to get kids to do something, you phrase the rules positively, right? So instead of saying no running in the hallways, everyone says walk, children. If you want to say, you know, don't step on the grass, you say stay on the path. If you want to say don't litter in the forest, you say, you know, take everything with you, right?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So what would be the equivalent of do not touch the critical space hardware?
I think maybe what we should have done is gotten a long jump rope and had all of the senators and gubernatorial staff or whatever. Yeah, and they all have to keep one hand on the jump rope at all times.
And the other hand in their pockets.
And the other hand in their pockets, yeah.
Oh, I would love to chaperone a field trip of...
Maybe we could just get them all fidget spinners. I don't know.
Oh, man. Yeah, the fidget spinner, then, you know, is if you get a government issue one, it's probably not super awesome, and one of the little parts flies free, and then you have some critical hardware failure due to the little fidget spinner ball bearing somewhere lodged in the middle of of the capsule. So I don't know if that's really best words, because it was not our tremendous commander-in-chief who did this, but it was the tremendous ding-dongs who work underneath him, apparently. You know, the fact that NASA has to then tweet out something saying, oh, no, we very much enjoyed your visit. What did they say? It was an honor to have you, sir.
Yes, it was an honor just to host you.
And the fact that not only is our vice president acting like a child that needs to have his hand on the jump rope knot during the field trip to the space center, but he also said, oh, yeah, it was Marco that dared me to do it. I mean, what kind of role models are these guys, you know, providing right. for us?
Yeah, just showing the utmost prestige and honor of their elected office.
Yeah, man. So there's some new things having to do with religious freedom that's kind of interesting, and I thought they would be right up your alley. The first one is brought to us by a group of Native American tribes. So a group of Native American and First Nation peoples of Canada and the U.S. have filed suit against the federal government for plans to remove Yellowstone grizzly bears from the endangered and threatened species list. Plaintiffs argue that trophy hunting is against their religious beliefs and request continued protection for the animal and consultation with the tribes before altering any protections. If the grizzlies are delisted, it would allow Montana, Wyoming, and Idaho to organize sanctioned bear hunts as long as the Yellowstone population does not fall below 600 individuals. What do you make of this, Dan?
Well, so currently the Yellowstone bear population, grizzly bear population, is about 700 individuals. It's pretty easy to imagine that number dropping precipitously very quickly.
What would cause something like 100 individuals in a population to die quickly?
Well, opening up trophy hunting, for one.
Okay, besides the trophy hunting.
But an important point about this population is they're a pretty closed population. They're an island population. They don't have a lot of genetic diversity. So like any small population of animals, they're already very susceptible to disease, to low breeding rates. Grizzlies are about 6 to 8 years old before they'll even have their first cub. And only one out of every three cubs will make it to adulthood. So this isn't a population that can just quickly bounce back. I mean, this is a population that has been protected since 1973. And it's taken that long to get from just over, I think, 150 individuals up to 700, which is still less than there were historically in the area. So if they were overhunted, if there was some sort of a miscalculation here where they got brought down below 600, we're not talking about, you know, oh, okay, well, we'll just put them back on the protected list and they'll be fine. We're talking about a population that's already very small, very vulnerable, and could easily be wiped out even by something as simple as a small epidemic disease.
So I would imagine that your perspective is we should keep these bears protected, keep them from being opened up to trophy hunting across three different states and things like that.
Right, right. I take some issue with trophy hunting. Basically, it serves no real function. There are places where deer are overpopulated because we've, you know, taken out their main predators and
those
filled
would be
up
wolves and bears mainly.
Right. Wolves, bears, pumas, that kind of thing. Because we've taken out their main predators and because we've filled up the land with agricultural crops, which is a much easier food source than having to forage in the forests or even in the grasslands for deer. So we'll have deer that are overpopulated, and in that case, it is necessary to cull the herds at some point, you know, to keep the deer from starving to death on their own.
It also will keep deer from entering a lot of roadways. I mean, I know where right. I grew up in New England, you had sort of that second regrowth of forest, and you had huge deer populations because there were, you know, just as you described, different set of circumstances. And you frequently have deer that are running into cars and really causing horrible, you know, auto wrecks, both for the deer populations and for the human populations trying to live alongside.
Right. But this isn't a thing that's happening in Yellowstone Park with grizzly bears. And with at least with deer, there is a secondary function. You're not just culling the herds, but you're also getting meat. I haven't eaten grizzly myself. I've talked to people from Alaska who have, and they say that, you know, even among the hunted bears, that it was sort of like the least choice, because grizzlies they're not just predators. They're also scavengers and herbivores. They kind of eat whatever they will. And a general rule of thumb for hunters is that if a bear lives within 40 miles of a garbage dump, it's going to taste like garbage.
Oh, dear.
Now, most of the garbage cans in Yellowstone are very bear proof. But that doesn't mean that they're not still getting waste, you know. And so
if you have a nice bear that has just been feasting on honey and blackberries, you're going to have really sweet, tender meat. But if you have a bear that's been feasting on garbage peanut butter sandwiches and camping things.
Right. Yeah, that's sort of like the general rule of thumb about, you know, hunting anything that's a scavenger type predator. So really, it's not really serving a purpose here. The purpose of hunting the grizzlies in Yellowstone would be, let's hunt the grizzlies in Yellowstone, because I want to have a bearskin rug and show how macho I am and all that kind of stuff. And it doesn't serve an ecological function. They're not overpopulated. They're not going to be hunted for their meat. I don't really see a purpose here besides going, I want to hunt a grizzly bear because it's a grizzly bear.
So here's the thing, though. In order to alter this or stop this, put an injunction against opening up grizzlies for hunting, you have this really kind of interesting situation from the perspective of myself, a secularist and an atheist, saying, let's utilize something granted to people, which is religious freedom. And you know, the Religious Freedom Restoration Act of 1993 actually really has its roots in the rights of indigenous native cultures of the Americas to be able to practice their faith, you know, unencumbered and unburdened by the federal government. So you there's this rich history of at least for, you know, 25 years of Native peoples being able to say, hey, stop doing this. It interferes with my religious practice. But now you have both Native Americans of the U.S. and First Peoples Nations of Canada filing suit against the U.S. government under this provision that says I should be able to practice my religion, even in places that I don't reside in or that I don't have a geographic ancestral tie to, because you have people as, you know, as far south as Oklahoma and Arizona that are party to this suit. So for me, it puts me in this kind of strange position as I'm basically in agreement that I think that trophy hunting of an endangered and threatened and vulnerable population, even if they're stable at the moment, is probably a crummy idea. But at the same time, do I really want this cornerstone of, you know, this little, you know, religious privilege clause to be used in favor of something that I'm ostensibly for?
Right. I guess that's a really tricky one. And, you know, I think there's something to be said for comparing the situations. You know, when we're talking about remnant human populations of Native American descent that are sort of clinging to a shrinking way of life, they're the survivors of a genocide, of the world's largest genocide so far. I think there's a difference between looking at this culture and saying they have a right to practice their religious beliefs unencumbered, and even you know using the minutiae of their beliefs to protect these species, versus looking at the American Christian, which is one of the largest religious demographics in the world, and using that to leverage minority populations going the other way. It's sort of like the it's like the racism argument, you know, where people will say, well, there's no such thing as reverse racism. I'm kind of inclined to agree that there's no such thing as reverse racism, because racism involves the institution, you know, that sure, there are minority persons who are racist against the majority, but that's not racism with a capital R, because it's not, you know, it's not the governmental institutions applying it.
So in this circumstance, you would argue that the religious freedom, the exercise of religious freedom from a minority group of peoples or marginalized groups of peoples in favor of a cause that is, in our view, justified, would be worth the utilization of that Religious Freedom Restoration Act exercise.
Boy, that's a tricky sentence, and maybe put some words in my mouth that aren't exactly there, but I won't say that I'm unhappy to see it going this way.
Fair.
I'll say in the state of Washington that the sacredness of treaties and the rights to the indigenous people for their traditional fish and game have done a tremendous amount of good work for the conservation movement. And it's not something that I like to, consider lightly.
That's fair. There's another case though, on the other side of the, continent. An open-air chapel established by Catholic nuns from the Adorers of the Blood of Christ was dedicated today in Pennsylvania on land set to be crossed by an oil pipeline being built on their land. The ceremony was hosted by a group, Lancaster Against Pipelines, in a protest dubbed Stand With the Sisters. The Federal Energy Regulatory Commission ruled that an Oklahoma company in charge of the pipeline may construct, maintain, and operate on the nuns' land under eminent domain. Although the chapel dedication took place before eminent domain has gone into effect, pipeline proponents filed an emergency order this week to expedite seizure of the adorers' land. The sisters claim that such use of their property violates their faith, which includes a land use ethic. So here you have religious Catholics and protesting the installation of an oil pipeline, something that you've also been vocal about.
That is correct.
Decrying, right? And you have someone that's you know, the Catholics are a minority within the United States, but I'm along the East Coast, not a tremendous minority, and we have examples of Catholics having, generally been fully integrated and accepted into American life. Yet you have nuns exercising their religious freedom to protest the seizure of their land via eminent domain. How does this then differ from the Grizzlies?
Well, I think part of it is, you know, who is using which tool against which demographic? And in this case, it's a religious majority demographic. I mean, the Catholic Church is one of the largest powers on the planet. And in this case, these sisters are using that religious freedom to subvert another of the largest powers on the planet, which is oil companies, with equal religious fervor.
I'm interested to see how that'll come out. I mean, it's been like celebrity rap battle, you know, right. Vatican versus the oil pipeline companies, or a celebrity death match.
Yeah. There's an interesting thing I would like to sort of debate on this, though, is the idea of eminent domain for an oil pipeline. So eminent domain is intended to serve the national good. And this has been a major argument against the construction of a lot of oil pipelines, because they're not serving the national good. They're serving a multinational corporation. Do they create a lot of American jobs? Briefly. Until construction is seeded, and then they drop down significantly. But what they cost in land and damage and that kind of stuff is tremendous. So when I see eminent domain being used, to me, it signals corruption. And, you know, if anybody should be maybe a little bit more wise and careful about corruption. It's not just oil companies, but also the Catholic Church. So this is kind of like,
You're using something that chips away at separation of church and state to combat something that chips away at a foundation of common good.
Right. Yeah. It's.
Is this a case of two wrongs not making a right?
Well, I think it's sort of a case of even if the pipeline gets built, I'll at least be happy to see that the Catholics weren't able to use religious freedom to alter federal policy, even if that policy is one that I don't like. But on the other hand, I kind of want to see the pipeline subverted by any means. So it becomes a really tricky thing.
Non-violent, non-destructive chapel of nice ladies wearing headscarves seems like a relatively small cost.
Right. But on the other hand, if it works, then I'll still be kind of ticked off because we have, you know, thousands, tens of thousands of protesters at Standing Rock couldn't accomplish the same thing that a handful of nuns were able to, which, boy, does that speak on white and religious privilege.
Man, I mean, that's just a lot of stuff that is really complex, and maybe we'll come back to it, and we'd like to see how that those nuns end up and how they fare. This is Ask an Atheist with Sam Mulvey, 844-SKEPTIC. We'll be back after the break.
I'm Mike Gillis.
And I'm Casey Doran, and we want to ask you an important question.
Are you sick and tired of other panel discussion shows wasting your time droning on and on about foreign policy, economics, and human rights?
Or do you want to hear conversations about things that actually matter?
We host a podcast called Radio Versus the Martians. Every month we gather a panel of our nation's finest minds and plunge a rusty prison shank into the heart of tough questions that have an impact on the lives of real people like you.
Like, are drivers required to pull over for the Ghostbusters?
Is United Federation of Planets actually an oppressive dictatorship run by guidance counselors?
Is Arnold Schwarzenegger secretly a genius?
And are we being mean when we laugh at movies that are so bad they're good?
So write your congressman and let them know that Radio Versus the Martians is available on iTunes, Stitcher, and on RadioVersusTheMartians.com.
Billy, I am a Nigerian prince, and I want to hide $1 billion in your locker.
Wow, $1 billion?
All I need is your lunch money.
What a great deal. Here you go.
Wait, Billy. Just because you want to believe something doesn't mean you should. Come to Camp Quest Northwest, where you'll learn critical thinking and science in a fun-filled, week-long nature camp.
No!
Camp Quest Northwest can be found at campquestnorthwest.org. Donations and volunteers accepted. The devil is not real.
Welcome back to Ask an Atheist, 844-SKEPTIC. Give us a voicemail anytime. And now for a special treat, we have Karen Garst in the studio. Karen Garst is the Oregon-based author of Women Beyond Belief. She blogs at faithlessfeminist.com and joins us in the studio today. Welcome, Karen.
Thank you so much for having me.
So have you always been faithless?
No, I have not. I was raised in Bismarck, North Dakota, so you get two guesses of what I was raised as.
Is that Lutheran?
That'd be Lutheran, yeah. Sure, you betcha. Yeah. But it wasn't at all fundamentalist. I thought it was very open, very accepting of science. My father was very religious, but very supportive of science. We studied evolution in school. The church never said anything about it. For a lot of people, it was their social life. We did a lot of activities. We had a Luther League in junior high and high school, and we did bowling. We did roller skating and different things like that. And I don't know if you know a lot about Lutheran churches, but the basement is where all the potlucks are. Yeah.
That's the social hall, fellowship hall?
That's the social hall down there. You know, that's where the women go and cook, lutefisk and stuff like that.
This is the casserole dungeon?
Yeah. Oh, casserole dungeon. Be sure to put your name on masking tape on the bottom of your dish so you can take it home. Yes. I even have a book called Lutheran Basement Women, a cookbook.
So that actually seems to be very, in general, positive of an experience in a religious foundation. What then brought you away from faith?
Well, it's kind of a long story, but what was interesting growing up in Bismarck is I knew what church everyone went to. And I knew there were five Jewish families. There was one Catholic school. Now, I'll tell you a little funny story about the Catholic school. Their theme song was When the Saints Come Marching In. And when I went to college, somebody had that on, and I said, oh, how did you know St. Mary's theme song? Oops. It was a song that everyone know that they took on. I thought it was just associated with St. Mary's High School. What did I know? I did go to a Lutheran college, Concordia College in Warren, Minnesota, but again, very liberal. My first Religion 101 class talked about the four oral strains of the Old Testament. The J for
the Yahwist. And
yes, exactly. P for priestly, etc. And talked about the exile in Babylon as a real historical verifiable event. And then in my second year, we were studying cities and society, and we got to pick a topic. I went to the library, found a book called Gay World, read about it, didn't know anything about it before, and said, well, that seems fine to me. I don't know why they're passing laws against it. So pretty liberal.
So you haven't always been faithless. Have you always been a feminist?
I think it's fair to say I've always been a feminist. I am... came of age in the 60s and 70s. We had a newspaper at Concordia College, and I was working with the other students on it, and we put in an ad for a call to the New York City abortion hotline.
Ooh.
Because that's the only place it was legal at that time. And the president impounded all the newspapers. Needless to say, they didn't go out. And then I went to graduate school and really kind of drifted away. I did finally, in my 30s, go to a Lutheran church. Again, pretty liberal. Was married in church to my lapsed Catholic husband. And we went to a church called Living Enrichment Center in Wilsonville. It was New Thought. It would hardly be called religious. And then when that folded, we just drifted away. And I think what's interesting, compared to a lot of people, I didn't seek out any community groups. I didn't know anything about the Humanists of Greater Portland or CFI. We just, you know, slept in on Sundays and went our own way.
So you've kind of settled into this life of being both faithless and with a rich history of feminism from the 60s, from sort of the Betty Friedan and Gloria Steinem eras and things like that. You know, feminism is a sort of an ever-evolving thing. And at a time when some women are really shying away from the term feminism or feminist, why do you lean into it?
Well, that's a very interesting question. I think if I knew what I knew today, I might have picked another title. But when I hired a marketing person, the first title he proposed for my, because he said, you have to have a blog, you just can't write a book, was Godless Grandmother. And I said, could we not emphasize my age and the fact that, yes, I am a grandmother? And he came up with Faithless Feminist. And I thought, well, I've always been a feminist. But I was a second wave feminist, and I didn't really pay attention to a lot of the things that were happening with third wave. And then after that, there's certainly a segment of radical feminists, and now there's a men's rights activist movement. So the word has changed a lot. But outside, let's say, academia or social media, if you ask somebody, a woman on the street, what does feminism mean to you? 9 times out of 10, they're going to say equal rights for women. So I think, yes, there is a percentage, there is a sphere where that's become a bad word and people do not want to identify with it. But I think it's a small piece.
Speaking of the sort of select crowds, can you tell us a little bit more about your experience being kicked out of an online group, which was ostensibly for atheist feminists?
Well, that was really interesting. Shanna Babylonia, who was a very, very good writer, and she had a blog. She no longer has it. But we got to be friends, and we decided to do some posts together. And she selected the topic, We Need More Secular Men. You know, it's probably not something I would have picked, but because I mostly write about women. But I said, sure, we'll do it. And we wrote it together. And I have a habit of posting my blog each week to about 30 or 40 atheist Facebook groups. And I try to follow up on every comment. So I had posted it to this blog called Atheist Feminists, No Gods, No Masters. And I just happened to get on it when they were having a conversation. So it was actually like a live chat. And one of the women said, well, this is a joke, right? This post about needing more secular men. Says, no, it's not a joke. You know, have you had a chance to read it? And they said, well, we don't want men. And I said, look, how would we have gotten, women have gotten suffrage if we didn't work with men to get it? How would we have worked on the Equal Rights Amendment, or that of course hasn't passed yet, or the Civil Rights in 1964 that included gender, if we wouldn't have worked with men? And their response was, oh, she's probably going to go and bake them cakes. And and so I was kicked off the group. But I did write a blog post about it, so I kind of felt good that I got back.
It's really interesting, and I actually do cock my head a little bit at the idea of we need more secular men, given that many times many of our foundational humanistic writers in American humanism and whatnot, and many prominent atheists are men. Many of the voices that are prominent among secularism are men. And so what sort of motivates this call to having more secular men? Is it men in particular? Is there a lack of secular men? Or is it just a call in general for more men to embrace secularism as opposed to religion?
The latter. And it was a topic she picked. But you're absolutely right. When I first started this project before I wrote my book, I did a survey on Amazon, and I didn't realize there was a list already. I did it all by hand. But I picked 100 top-selling atheist books, and out of those 100 at that time, there were 6 that were written by women.
Wow.
I also, as part of my preparation for doing presentations, et cetera, I've probably read 100 books in the last 3 years and countless YouTube videos. And I noticed virtually on all the debates, it's men and men. And one of the things I did was call some of the women atheists that I had come across as writers, et cetera, and say, you know, why aren't you out there? A lot of women will write a book and then they don't follow up on it, or they move on to another topic. But I think it's really important to have role models. When I was growing up, the role models for me as a young woman were secretary, nurse, and teacher. And I remember a 9th grade class on evolution, and I wrote a paper about early hominids, and it was fascinating to me. It never occurred to me to be an anthropologist. You know, I'd never heard of Margaret Mead. I just never had heard of any of that. So one of the motivations for writing my book was to say, it's easier if you have a role model that you can identify with. And so these 22 women who wrote for me between the ages of 18 and 70 are from all different walks of life. One was born in Zimbabwe. One was born in Peru. There's people who have immigrated to the United States, as well as people who grew up here. So I think it gives people a model. They read it and they can say, oh, my deconversion isn't going to be as bad as that. Or if she can do it, I can do it. So that's why I think it's really important.
Can you tell us a little bit more about your book, Women Beyond Belief?
Yeah, the book is composed of 22 essays of women that I've described a little bit. And each of them write their personal stories of leaving religion. And because a lot of these people hadn't, you know, published before, I hired an editor. And she helped everyone develop their essay and make it better. And I think that was well worth it. And I would be happy to read some excerpts of a few of them. And they're all very, very different.
So in addition to just merely giving voice to women who maybe not are heard, at least along the atheist bestseller lists, also embracing and helping these women refine their craft of writing. Is that what I'm hearing?
Exactly.
So can you share one of these excerpts or a few of them for
us? Yes, I'll share a couple of them. The first excerpt is written by... it's a pseudonym because some of her family doesn't know she's an atheist. Anne Wilcox. As I tried to let my beliefs go, my head seemed far ahead of the rest of me. I would think, that makes no sense. But I would be assailed by intense fear and doubt. I felt all of my old fears and beliefs still skulking inside, like the biblical Leviathan, a sea monster that lurked in the deep. I felt wrong, as though I had committed a terrible crime and I was going to be punished. Whenever I got near anything to do with my religion, a Christian coworker, a bumper sticker, a debate or a speaker, something on the internet or the news, even or especially my own family, I went into a tailspin of dread and doubt for days. I kept thinking the fear would diminish, but it went on for months and months. My fear was so ingrained that as I wrestled with my beliefs, I had shadowy nightmares, and I felt like things were creeping up on me in the middle of the night. As I sat in my chair reading, there were times when I involuntarily glanced upward, as if lightning might strike through my ceiling. When I attacked my beliefs about Satan, it felt as if he was in my room with me. This was a complete surprise, not to mention freaky. After 30 years away from my religion, my mind was still being assaulted with irrational fear for disbelieving. And I think that's very telling of when you're indoctrinated at a young age, it's very difficult to leave that behind. Now, I can tell you, I've talked to her in the last year or two, and she was at the Oregon coast sitting on a rock and had an epiphany. She said, "I'm okay. I'm a good person. I feel good about myself." But it took her 30 years. And the writing, she said, really helped.
It's pretty amazing. And I personally can relate to some of those things. Even when you have left a belief, sometimes things you are so uncomfortable with that you were taught when you were young. It took me a very long time to be able to feel comfortable eating bacon. It's delicious. It's wonderful. But coming from a very lovely, pluralistic, liberal Jewish background, you still get this message saying that's not food. That's something you don't eat. And it's very hard to then put it into your mouth, chew it, and swallow it, right? And it can be something as simple as eating bacon or of convincing yourself that Satan isn't there telling you that you're a bad person, even after 30 years. Those are pretty powerful sort of common threads that you can see, I imagine, with anyone who leaves religion. But is there something particular to the women's experience or to the female experience of leaving religion that bogs us down with some of those things?
Well, as I talked about my background in Lutheranism and talked about it being pretty liberal, there was one area where it wasn't, and that was sex. I remember in fifth grade when we had the girls' movie, and of course the boys were totally teasing us, "Why don't the boys get a movie?" And they wanted to know what it was about. And it was put on, I found out later, by Kotex and Walt Disney. And it was trying to explain menstruation. It was so obtuse, I didn't get it. I walked home. I walked in the house. I said, "Mom, what's menstruation mean?" at the top of my lungs. And she sat down and drew a little chart. And I probably never said the word out loud again. But she never talked about the male anatomy. And the way I learned about sex was I purloined my sister's porn book.
Oh.
Harold Robbins wrote 79 Park Avenue. And unfortunately, in that story, the shopkeeper rapes a young woman. So that's what I figured out what intercourse was, through rape. And you're also taught that you should be a virgin, you should be married. And I think that is something that a lot of religions still are very set on, that affects women more than it does men, but it affects men as well. And so you have a lack of education. And at that time, of course, there was no sex education in the schools. And, you know, I know both my parents are virgins when they were married. You think they would have said, "That was tough. Let's do something different for our kids." But they never taught any of us. And there's a funny story about that. So I've come through a lot of my knowledge through book learning. And that book talked about whores. And I heard some girls in junior high talking about whores. And I said, and I knew they were talking about prostitutes. And I said, "That word's not pronounced whore. It's spelled W-H-O-R-E. It must be war." Totally embarrassed. Totally embarrassed. So,
well, we always say don't make fun of someone who mispronounces a word, because it meant that they learned it through reading.
Exactly.
Which is something to celebrate, right?
Exactly.
That's right. Making fun of someone for that would be a cruel facade.
Let me read another episode. This is a little different. This is a woman who was raised Mormon, and her entire story is about one car ride from the house to the airport. And you'll get it as I read it. "The tension in the car that horrible day was as thick as the gray fog outside. It felt as dark as a night with no moon. No one would speak of the purpose of this drive, but oh, I wanted to. I wanted to shout out that she wasn't a bad child. She was just acting like the teenager she was. 13. She was only 13. I wanted to tell them that they needed to love her unconditionally. I wanted to scream horrible names at them, tell them they were traitors and liars. Who cared if she'd had sex? Who cared if it was with a bishop's son? Why couldn't his parents send him away? Why was grandma's good standing more important than her love for my sister? Why wasn't our mom fighting for her daughter? Due to insurance issues, my mom had signed custody to my grandmother for what was supposed to be a year, but grandma wouldn't sign it back. My grandma then used it to hurt and control my mom. I kept thinking, yell, mama, yell, fight, please, fight. Custody is just a piece of paper. Grandma has no right. God made you her mama. And that trip was to the airport where they sent the girl away to live with her aunt and uncle because they didn't want it known that she had slept with the bishop's son. Mm. And of course, nothing happened to the bishop's son.
Really highlighting that discrepancy of experience between young women and young men. Wow, it's powerful.
So you have a fairly diverse sample here of different faiths. Was that deliberate? Did you make a specific effort to involve as many faiths as possible?
Well, I started out asking my friends who I knew were atheists, and one of my best friends was raised in England, and when she moved as an adult to the United States, they moved to the South. And in England, when you want to know directions, they say, oh, it's two doors down from the Lucky Lab, the tavern. And when she moved to the Southern United States, it was, oh, it's just past the Lutheran Church. She was raised secular. She had no idea where the Lutheran Church was. And then I reached out through social media to get a little more diversity. I joined the Humanists of Greater Portland, the Center for Inquiry in Portland, and then got some other people involved.
I'm curious about one of the women featured in the collection of essays who says specifically that she is not a feminist and she doesn't identify as a feminist. How did you come to understand her statement?
Well, Sylvia Benner was the head of the CFI, and she was born in Germany, raised mostly secular. And I, after she had written the essay, went and sat down to talk with her because I just couldn't get it. I said, why aren't you a feminist? Why aren't you for women's rights? And she said, well, I think women in the United States, not elsewhere, but pretty much have equal rights, and that there's some areas where men are really disadvantaged. And one of the key ones is having to register for the Selective Service and possibly be drafted for war. And there's other statistics where certainly the prison population is more men. In the past, men getting custody of their children was more difficult. There, I think, have been some studies about sentences being handed out. I think all of that is changing. But she just felt attention should more be paid there. Now, I disagree with that. I've had experiences in my own life where I have had to stand up for my role as a woman. I had an experience when I was with the Oregon State Bar where they were hiring somebody, and I was a director, but we had this subsidiary for malpractice insurance, and I knew what was going to happen. So I kind of gave them, the board, all the salaries where everyone was and said, this is where this person should fit in. I had 90 employees, he had 40, et cetera. And what did they do? They hired him at $30,000 more than I was making. And this was, you know, I retired in 08, so it wasn't that long ago. And I went to the board and said, totally unacceptable, I'll file a lawsuit. And they said, well, let's do a study. And they hired a consultant to do a study. And the person doing the study said, hey, she's got more responsibility. The only thing I can come up with is sex discrimination. And they gave me a $30,000 raise.
Well done, then.
Thank you.
Nice
Thank
job.
You. Yeah.
So in terms of those issues, you know, you may disagree with Sylvia's position on those particular things, but, you know, I mean, it is a fact that, you know, men have had difficulty in terms of custody and may have higher conviction rates in the criminal justice system and things like that. And those are all issues that are really important to wrestle with, I believe, from a feminist perspective as well. Because you have, you know, feminism to a lot of people can mean equal rights and no, you know, unfair treatment and inequitable treatment between someone based on gender, whether it's through pay or parenting or things like that. But there's some ways that are very tense in the ways in which feminism intersects with atheism. And I want to ask sort of a sensitive question, and it's what do you make of some conflicting and, in my opinion, some seemingly grandiose statements by atheists that, you know, may have critical followings either through blogs or YouTubes that, you know, on one hand, you see people saying atheism as a movement has been infiltrated and destroyed by feminists. And on the other extreme, atheism is a movement full of misogynist white men that leave no place for women and marginalized people. What do you sort of make of this tension as someone who has spent countless hours watching YouTube videos, interacting with different groups, and maintaining a blog yourself?
Well, kind of like our current president, some people should think before they tweet, you know. And so I know there was somebody who tweeted something that later he retracted. I feel personally, and I've been to the Reason Rally, I've been to the Women's Secularism that is put on conference. And I feel totally accepted. I've been on a lot of podcasts. A lot of podcasts are done by men, atheists, and everyone listens to my viewpoint. So I don't know. It's kind of like social media. I find when I post a blog, if I get a really negative comment from somebody and I answer all of them, the first thing I will say, and they're usually men, well, I will say, what would your mother think if you did that? And then we start a conversation. And I had one the other day where somebody disagreed on some key points I was making, which I would have been happy to discuss, but he put in between there these words like facepalm, and different stuff like that. And I started a dialogue, and the administrator said, look, if you're going to disagree with her, she's referenced everything in her blog post. You need to come up with references. And he did, and we were going to explore it further. He went back and changed his post. He took out those offensive words. So I really think engaging in a dialogue with somebody who may be initially saying it, maybe just venting and hoping that nobody's going to answer, but working with them and having a dialogue and discussion, and frankly, I thought he raised some good points. I'm happy to talk about it. I make mistakes. I'm happy to correct them.
Well, Karen, it's been really lovely hearing from you and some of the excerpts in your book. How can listeners follow up with you and your writings?
Well, the book is Women Beyond Belief, Discovering Life Without Religion. It is now available as a paperback, Kindle, and the audiobook just came out. Just doing pretty well. I realize people listen to books sometimes more than they read them. I also have a blog that I post weekly, www.faithlessfeminist.com. And I have a YouTube channel under the same name. Generally there, I will post something where I've made a presentation. One of the presentations I do is From Goddess to God, Elimination of the Feminine Divine, and I trace the figurines in the Paleolithic all the way through the Iron Age and the establishment of monotheism in many cultures. And it's
and you thought you couldn't be an anthropologist. Look at you now.
Am I too old to take that on now? I'd kind of like to do that. But and that presentation, you know, looking at how there was a feminine divine, even in a pantheon of god and goddesses, and that got completely eliminated. That was a big mistake. And I do believe that religion is the last cultural barrier to gender equality.
Well, Karen, thank you so much. Karen Garst is the Oregon-based author of Women Beyond Belief. She blogs at faithlessfeminist.com. And we were so happy to have you in the studio today. Thank you.
Thank you.
Hasn't God We Trust invaded your town? Are you tired of government officials who want to plaster In God We Trust on taxpayer-owned property? Are you afraid because your local sheriff placed an In God We Trust decal on the patrol cars? We are here to help. The original motto project is for those who feel the separation of church and state is an important issue and should be honored regardless of your belief or lack thereof. Theists, non-theists, and all free thinkers are welcome. We need your support to show politicians that diversity exists within our nation, and their promotion of a monotheistic religion and push for theocracy will not be tolerated. Stand up and be heard. Join us at originalmotto.us.
Allegedly, soccer is a beautiful game.
It is when you know what's going on.
That's the problem. MLS is 20 years old, and people are still shocked to hear that there's an American Soccer League.
That's why you and I are talking about it. This is a discussion of American soccer for nerds and beginners. It's a good first step if a crippling soccer addiction is something that's missing from your life.
Join the club. Celebrate the 20th anniversary of MLS by actually following the season.
Hands-Free Football. New episodes every week at handsfreefootball.com. Bring it back, but it's
more than basic. Need a break from the theistic world?
Live in the Seattle area?
Like the Flying Spaghetti Monster?
Whether you're an ardent non-believer, steadfast agnostic, or marauding Pastafarian, check out the award-winning nonprofit organization Seattle Atheists.
Socialize at the Third Thursday meetup, attend lectures, come camping, donate blood.
Connect at seattleatheists.org.
Seattle Atheists, we believe in you.
Welcome back to Ask an Atheist. In the studio now, still Dan, but also we're welcoming Colby. How are you, Colby?
Doing all right.
It's really nice to have you in the studio for the first time. So, there were some things, did you guys get crafty in the summertime?
Oh, definitely.
Yeah.
Yeah? You like doing, like, arts and crafts? I mean, Colby, you're an artist by training, right?
Yeah.
So, you know, I mean, not quite the resonating, beautiful canvas kind of thing, but, you know, maybe some summer camp, little arts and crafts, friendship bracelets.
Sticks and glue.
Yeah, friendship bracelets kind of things. Maybe.
Some macaroni and glitter. Yeah.
Well, speaking of which, Oklahoma-based craft retailer Hobby Lobby has agreed to pay a $3 million fine and to forfeit thousands of smuggled Iraqi antiquities. Owner Steve Green had planned on displaying the items in his privately owned Museum of the Bible to be opened this fall in Washington, D.C. The U.S. Department of Justice tallied that over 5,500 artifacts, such as clay seals, tablets, and blocks, had been looted and smuggled from Iraq and eventually made their way to the U.S. via Israel and the United Arab Emirates, deceptively labeled as Turkish ceramic tiles. This was despite having been advised against purchasing the artifacts by a cultural property law expert retained by Hobby Lobby, who warned that they were likely looted from Iraq. As part of the DOJ settlement, Hobby Lobby will also submit quarterly reports to the government on cultural property acquisitions through 2019. So is this the kind of arts and crafts you guys play with over the summer?
No, definitely not.
I always like to make sure that you know, when I'm doing arts and crafts in the summertime, that I loot less developed nations and then fraudulently label the packages that I'm sending to my retail outlets.
You have some retail outlets? So these were labeled ceramic tile samples, and where was the country of origin was faked as Israel or
Turkish.
Turkey in this case.
Turkey, yeah.
The kicker, I can't believe they actually hired someone to say, "Hey, can you help us import these things?" And they said, "You shouldn't import these things," and they imported the things. I mean, where do they get off trying to say that they can just, you know, take these things that were clearly looted from war-torn countries? I mean, these are biblical antiquities or antiquities of biblical age.
Mm-hmm. Right.
What do you think motivates people to do this?
I imagine that in this case, maybe their religious fervor and their zeal for starting this museum led them to do some less than ethical things.
Well, we know about Steve Green for his Hobby Lobby exploits.
Oh, yes.
Mm-hmm. You've got the, "We don't want to give our employees birth control," or "We don't want to give our employees a medical plan that pays for birth control," mm-hmm. as if, you know, you can control what your, you know, I mean, that's like saying your employer says, "I don't want to give you a paycheck that you're going to then spend on your car because I don't believe in cars."
Right.
I mean, as if that's a thing that, you know, governments or the employees can do. We also know Steve Green as the guy who has his own biblical curriculum that he wants to push on public schools, mm-hmm. right? And this Museum of the Bible, have you guys read about it much or heard about where it's going to be?
Honestly, this is the first that I've heard of it.
Yeah, it's the first that I've heard of it, but isn't it supposed to be in D.C.?
Along the walk of all of the, you know, Smithsonian museums, which are free and open for the good of the public, right?
Mm-hmm.
And you have this one that is a privately owned museum, so nicely just, you know, a little stealthing in there, saying, "Oh, yes, we're just a museum just like all the other ones."
Maybe we can get Thomas Jefferson's ghost to erect a wall between them.
Oh, that would be lovely. I think there will actually be, I was reading about it. They said that they're planning on having a garden that's landscaped with biblical plants and things like that. I think that their cafe is going to serve flatbread and date honey and things like that. I don't know. I don't want to eat biblical foods. I mean, growing up, did you guys ever celebrate Passover as non-Jewish people? I know some Christian churches will sometimes have a Passover Seder and things like that.
No, we didn't.
Well, you've tasted, though, matzah, right?
Yes.
And so that's basically eating saltine crackers that are unsalted for 8 days straight. I don't want to replicate this eating experience.
I got to say, I actually went to my very first Passover Seder ever just this year. And, you know, people kept telling me, oh, matzah's terrible, matzah's terrible, matzah's terrible. I don't know why, but for some reason I liked it. But I also want to point out that I am a person who will buy a bag of egg noodles and eat them as if they were potato chips. Uncooked egg noodles like you would use in making
I think we call
soup,
that
so.
Being the outlier, Dan.
I think I would be the outlier. I am very far from the bell curve in this case.
So we've got Hobby Lobby that just doesn't really give a damn about whether the provenance of its things that it's buying for its private religious institution is actually funding terrorism or not, or has actually been the product of looting, of terrorist and war-torn based looting. But onto that, or on from that, we have another place of antiquity, not quite as antique as Iraq. We go now to the Vatican.
Oh, dear.
What's with the pre-giggles, Dan? Vatican police raided the apartment of a top Catholic priest and discovered a drug-fueled gay orgy after neighbors complained of frequent nighttime visitors. The apartment is owned by the Congregation for the Doctrine of the Faith, which is, incidentally, the organization that reviews cases related to sexual abuse of children. One priest was hospitalized for intoxication and is now residing at a Vatican retreat center. The priest may have been the secretary of Cardinal Francesco Cocopalmerio, president of the Council for Legislative Texts. Cocopalmerio reportedly had recommended his secretary for a promotion to bishop. So what do you think about those job prospects there?
What was that?
So drug-fueled gay sex orgy.
At the Vatican.
It's an apartment owned by... It's in the Vatican. It's in Vatican City, and it's an apartment that's owned by the Vatican and operated ostensibly for the, you know, Congregation for the Doctrine of Faith to investigate sex scandals and sex abuse. And I will absolutely make the distinction. If you want to have a drug-fueled gay orgy with consenting adults, that's no skin off my nose.
Yeah, go
and
for
that's
it.
Completely different. From the sexual abuse of minors.
Yes.
So I just got to keep repeating it. Drug-fueled gay sex orgy in the Vatican. It's not so much that we've got, you know, dudes having drugged up sex. It's that you have dudes having drugged up sex from an organization
specifically legislates
founds
against
itself that holds up its, you know, its morality as itself as moral arbiters that are engaging in the thing that they morally rail against.
Exactly.
And, you know, we've got this guy that unfortunately had to be hospitalized, apparently for whatever drug he had OD'd on, which I'm glad that they raided the apartment. I'm giggling now because the official translation from the complaint was that there were odd nighttime visitors and they were disturbed by the unusual comings and goings of the nighttime visitors. It just doesn't get any better than that.
Nope.
So I read a little bit more into this one because who could resist a headline like that? The apartment in question has one door that is in Rome and one door that is in the Vatican. So
that's a really fun kind of tricky, like weird border crossing establishment.
Right. Yes. Yeah. So, I mean, we're talking about international smuggling here. this is similar to the last story. And in this case, all the higher ups are claiming, you know, no knowledge or we were the ones who called the police on them. You know, we were the ones who turned them in. And it just kind of cracks me up because, I mean, if you had intended to smuggle anything illicit into the Vatican directly through this apartment would be the best way. Or from the Vatican out into Rome, again, this would be exactly the way you'd want to do it, to have a building that was an international territory without a customs office inside that you can just walk into and out of, and which door you use determines which nation you're in. And furthermore, this priest had a car with Vatican license plates, which in Rome basically exempts them from search and seizure by police. So if you were trying to smuggle in drugs for no doubt the other drug-fueled gay sex orgies that occur in the Vatican, this would be exactly the place to do it. This would be the pinch point, if you will.
Oh, dear. So, no word on whether the secretary will get his promotion to bishop. and no word on whether they're going to change the location of the Congregation for the Doctrine of the Faith. No word on how their investigations and reviews of child sex scandals are going, apart from indicting or from the indictment of the Australian priest. What was his name? Pell, I think George Pell in Australia, who I don't even think was indicted and arrested under the Vatican's charges, but rather under local Australian law. So maybe if you want to have your gay drug-fueled sex orgy, get down with your bad self, as Sam is very wont to say, but maybe not do it when you're supposed to be investigating the abuse of minors. Oh, and also saying that no one should ever have sex with someone of the same gender as you, or maybe if you're a priest, sex at all. I mean, the level of this is quite astonishing, and just that extra little, you know, backdoor to Rome thing, you can't really get any better than that.
I liked it better when they were just blocking pipelines.
Oh man, maybe we should just leave things to the sisters, the adorers of the blood of Christ, who seem to be just, you know, building chapels and blocking pipelines rather
right.
than that's a way to get down with your bad self that doesn't
certainly.
You know,
and you know what? If you want to build a chapel and have a drug-fueled gay sex orgy in it, you know, go for it.
Even better if you're blocking.
Even better if you're blocking
pipelines or
right.
saving grizzly bears or.
Yeah, why not?
Oh, there's a bear joke in there somewhere, but.
Oh dear.
Moving on, it was Pride Week in Tacoma. This weekend kicked off Tacoma Pride, which is awesome. We had 2 days in downtown, and then there's a film series and some interfaith events and things like that going on. And it comes right on the cusp of a really awesome announcement. Supporters of Washington State's Initiative I-1552 failed to present sufficient signatures by 3 p.m. Friday to put a bathroom restriction law on November's ballot. I-1552 would have overridden state and local statutes that protect LGBT individuals from gender-based discrimination in bathrooms, school locker rooms, and other public places. It would also have barred lawsuits against schools that refuse to accommodate transgender and gender nonconforming students. Prominent Democrats and Republicans both expressed opposition to the initiative, as well as a coalition of 500 businesses and organizations that ran decline to sign campaigns. Well done, Washington State citizens.
Heck yeah.
So this has been going on for a little while. I went to a decline to sign rally down in Tacoma at UW-Tacoma. And it has a nice little ring to it, decline to sign. And well, apparently enough Washingtonians declined to sign. And the proponents of the bill, they actually, you know, had an appointment to drop off their signatures, and they just called mid-morning to cancel their appointment. Didn't even show up. Couldn't even show up. So this was the second year that they were running an initiative that is part of, as Sam says, the war on taking a dump. Right? So I think that we've just... rather put down our arms and say we don't want to fight this war anymore. We're really not dedicated to fighting the war on taking a dump. But have you guys actually, did you actually see the initiative and the signature gatherers and things like that?
Yeah, we were just recently at a park and we were approached by somebody who asked us, what was the exact wording?
They said it very quietly and they mm-hmm. said, do you believe in keeping men's and women's shower rooms separate?
And we were all, what?
No, we like gay drug-fueled sex orgies right, yes. in our apartments.
What? I don't know. Does it block a pipeline?
So, does it save a grizzly?
Yes.
So did you, I mean, I'm assuming that you guys declined to sign.
Oh, of course.
Certainly.
So what's the response that you actually have? Because I know that these initiatives are popping up as either voter initiatives or laws in different states around our country. What's sort of the response that you give these folks that say, do you want to protect the privacy of children and keep men's and women's shower rooms separate? I mean, what's the response that you have to that?
I mean, I want to yell at them and be like, what's wrong with you?
So you have someone, you don't strike me as a particularly belligerent park frequenter. So what do you respond then in order to say, do you just say, nope, no, thank you, and walk away? Or do you engage these folks?
I think it depends a little bit on the situation. In this situation, I was returning to my family, ironically from a public restroom, when the signature gatherer asked me if I wanted to keep men's and women's shower rooms separate, and I just kind of treated it like she had told me a bad joke. I said, "Oh no," and kept walking. What I did not realize is that Bridget, who is also regularly on the show, had already been asked by this person, and that she had kind of flown off and raised her voice, and the signature gatherer said, could you keep your voice down? She said, no, I will not keep my voice down. This is horrible. And I think that's exactly the right response. In fact, if I had not been returning back to my family and just trying to, you know, sort of enjoy the sunset, if I'd been there by myself and wasn't going to, you know, make things weird for my parents or anything like that, I probably would have been quite loud about it too. Because I think if someone wants to persecute someone in a public space, i.e. not allowing trans persons into the bathroom of their choice, then I think that person should also experience being persecuted in a public space. I think the right response is to be as loud as possible and make sure and let everyone around them know, hey, this person wants to know what kind of genitals you have. They're trying to exclude human beings from a place where they can go. They asked me if I believe in keeping men's and women's shower rooms separate. So I asked them if they believe in keeping whites and blacks drinking fountains separate, you know, that kind of thing. Like, I think that they should be absolutely publicly humiliated as much as possible until they're so ashamed that they choose to leave the scene. Because if you want to persecute people in public, you should first get persecuted in public.
It's an interesting take on it. Colby, how did you respond? Were you just the no thank you? You know, or have you raised your voice in a similar fashion in other circumstances?
I didn't raise my voice at the signature taker, but it did kind of spark something inside of me that made me really angry. I know somebody personally who is going through their transition, and this, like, I've always believed that this was wrong, but this person approaching me when I'm having a time with my friends and just interrupting that to push their beliefs of these people are wrong made me really angry, and I couldn't really say anything at that time.
So we kind of can say that, you know, it's not just about privacy in bathrooms or keeping shower rooms separate. It's about a belief that the existence of trans folks is wrong, is immoral.
Yeah.
That's a hard thing when people are couching their arguments as, this is just to protect people. This is just to have privacy. And at the end of the day, when you look at the letters of these laws, it does exactly the opposite of allowing privacy for individuals. When you must be subject to possible questioning about what's going on below the belt.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, there's no, you know, greater invasion of privacy than saying, you know, what's going on underneath your underpants, and why are you here, and leaving people open to that kind of harassment just seems so awful. And to hear it being couched as, now we should all have respectfully quiet voices, and we should all just want privacy and protections for our children, when they're the effect of their laws and their initiatives would upend that privacy, is really, it incenses me.
Absolutely. And I think, you know, the root of it here is, it's a public restroom. So if you're trying to exclude someone from a public restroom, what you're really saying is, I am excluding you from the public space. I don't want you to leave your house. And that's horrible to me. That's not the way that you treat a human being. It's regressive. It's I don't know. It's something that I keep waiting for human beings to be better than this, and it disappoints me every time it comes up. And I feel like that parent, you know, when I'm looking at like all of humanity, and there's like that one kid that just keeps misbehaving, and I look at them and be like, you know, I'm not mad. I'm just really disappointed. I think you're better than this.
He just needs to hold on to the jump rope knot. That's all.
Right, yeah.
We need to just put him back on the jump rope knot. And that's... Well, thank you, Colby, for joining us today in the studio. And Dan, it's always a pleasure to have you commenting on all sorts of things related to all of our awesome environmental goings on. This has been Ask an Atheist with Sam Mulvey. My name is Becky Friedman. Thank you, Colby. Thank you, Dan.
You're welcome.
You can email us at questions@askanatheist.tv, Twitter us, askanatheistwa, and give us a voicemail, 844-SKEPTIC. We will see you next week. Tacoma, happy Pride Week.